Y'all turn, please, to Genesis 12. We're going to start a new series on what? We're going to talk about an overview of the Bible, but more importantly, how it all fits together and relates to you. I know some of you guys have been studying this Bible a lot of years. Imagine I had a big pitcher of water and I poured it into this cup. You kind of concentrate it in a single spot. Whereas if I took the pitcher of water and I just poured it out on the table, it's going to go and be wasted. I'm not going to cover everything in the Bible. I'm going to skip hundreds of people and thousands of years. And so you don't need to help me with all the stuff you think I forgot. I'm just going for the irreducible minimum. Because if I pour out everything, it's going to be like pouring a pitcher of water on this table. It's going to go. There's a rule somebody came up with. It seems to be true that 20% of the things you do will give you 80% of the results you want. And what we're going to look at in the Bible today is the 20%. Well, not just today, but this series of talks. Resist the temptation, all you Bible scholars, to add in all the stuff I leave out. Otherwise, it's just going to be... We've got to go in like a laser focus on this thing and look at the big picture of the Bible. Let's start with the easiest stuff. The Bible's in two big sections. What are they called? Right. Now, the Bible is, of course, a book of books, right? How many books are in the Old Testament? Yes, 39. How many are in the New?
27.
27. Now, the silly way to remember that is you take the word old and the word testament. Write it out. How many letters are in old? And how many letters are in testament? There's 39 books in the Old Testament. Now, the problem with that is there's not 39 books in the New Testament. So how do you remember that? Well, the way you remember that is you take the 3 from the Old and the 9 from the Testament and multiply 3 times 9, what do you get? 27. So there's 27 books in the New Testament. That won't make you spiritual to know that. But it will remind you of the fact that the Bible is a book of books. How many in the whole Bible together? You just add those. Now, there was a translator named J.B. Phillips who translated the New Testament from Greek into English. And it's called the Phillips Translation. Had he translated the Old Testament as well, he could have put those two, the 39 books together with books of the New Testament. He could have called it Phillips 66. What does the word testament mean? Covenant. If it means covenant, why do they put testament? Well, it's anti. The translators don't like to change words that everybody's familiar with because it upsets them when they do. That's why it's Noah had an ark. What's an ark? Why don't they put Noah's box? It upsets people. That's the reason they don't translate baptizo. It upsets people when they do. So that's an antique way of saying contract, testament is, basically. That's what you have. The Old Testament is one of many testaments in the 39 books of the Old Testament. And, of course, the New Testament is our testament. So you know there's at least two testaments in the Bible, two covenants. There's actually many more than that. We're going to start with the most important one that's in the Hebrew Scriptures, and it's not the old one. It's one that comes before the old one. Now, what testament is the Old Testament, by the way? Mosaic Covenant. It was the contract between God and the Jewish people at what location? Mount Sinai. So that's the old one. Well, we're going to go before that, the one that's even older and more fundamental. And that's a covenant that God made with this guy named Abraham. In my opinion, my studied opinion, the two most important people in the Bible are Jesus and Abraham. Not Adam. Not Moses, not David, Abraham. Because what we're going to see today is the foundation for Jesus and the New Testament and forgiveness of sins. And we won't get to it all, but this is the foundation for it. So if you would please turn to Genesis 12, read 1 through 3. God tells this guy named Abram, Abram and Abraham, the same person, to do something. I want to know what God calls him to do. 1 through 3.
Now the Lord said, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. In you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
What's the basic thing God tells Abraham to do?
Leave home.
That's right. And so he got his Amex card and he left home. Where had he been living before he moved? Ur. If you look back to chapter 11, it'll tell you that. We won't take time to read it. What modern-day country is Ur located in? Iraq. That's modern-day Iraq, relatively near the ancient city of Babylon. That's right. So the Chaldeans became the Babylonians, and that's modern-day Iraq. Now, that's where he had been living, and then he moved from there to what city next? Anybody know? Haran, which is in modern-day Turkey. So let's look at that. This is where he was. Here's Ur. Okay, now here's modern-day Israel over here. Here's Egypt. Turkey's up there. So this is Iraq, and he moved up like this all the way up to Haran. Now, what modern-day country did I say that's in?
Turkey,
near the Syrian border. Then he left Haran, and he came down into what today is Israel. What was it called in Genesis? What do they call it? Don't call it Israel. What do they call it?
Canaan.
That's where the Canaanites lived. So that's where he went. Why didn't he go just like this? It was a lot shorter.
Desert.
Couldn't go that way. So here's a picture of modern-day Ur, back when we still had troops there. There's some of our troops at Ur. You can see there's a little bit left of it. And then here is Haran. It's still a street sign in Turkey there, and that's what's left of that. There's Haran. So that's where he went. Now let's look at the promises God made to Abraham. If you boil it down to three things, somebody that has never been to seminary and somebody who has been in this church less than 10 years, tell me the three things God promised Abraham.
Making you a great nation.
Okay, one thing, I'm going to make you into a great nation of people. What's another thing?
Make your name great.
That's one of the things he says.
Yeah.
Make your name great. What else?
I will bless you.
Some blessing cursing formula.
I will make your descendants exceed the number of the stars.
That's kind of like being a great nation. Yeah. And y'all are leaving out one big thing.
All the people on the earth will be blessed through you.
That's part of that blessing thing. It's more blessing. And there's one big thing y'all think you haven't said.
Land.
Go west, young man. Go west. So he left and he went west. Most theologians will boil all the things y'all said down into three things. The land, the seed, and the blessing. What three things did it boil them down to?
The land, the seed, and the blessing.
The land of Canaan is the land. The seed, that's a funny way to say it, refers to what?
Jesus.
Ultimately, it's Jesus, but immediately it referred to offspring. He's going to have a lot of kids, as Dan said, as many as there are stars. So that's the, what we would today call the Jewish people. The third thing was this blessing business. Through you, there will be a blessing to all the nations of the earth. The land, the seed, and the blessing. That's the three things we want to look at.
The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord.
Yeah, I will give this land. Also, look at chapter 13. He says, Lord said, Abraham, lift up your eyes and look from the place you are, northward and south, or east and west, for all the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring. Now, obviously, he says, go to a land. It kind of implies he's going to give it to him. And then when he gets there, he says, it's yours. And your kids. That's what he says. And then he says he's going to give him seed, and as you all said, into a great nation of people. Make his name great, which of course has happened. To your seed I will give this land. To your offspring I will give this land. So that's how it says it. And the third thing he promises is the blessing. And I want to emphasize the part, I will bless all the peoples of the earth through you. Now he also blessed him by making him filthy rich. But that's not significant for our purposes.
Real quick, it's kind of an aside. Something I was just struck with that I think is so cool about the Old Testament, right? And that all of these, you're reading about Abraham and all of the patriarchs. You can go to these places, and they've got like kind of pictures of the ruins and stuff.
Yeah.
Contrast that with something like Mormonism, where they have located anything. It's all made up. It's
thank you, brother.
Really cool to be able to see the ruins.
That's right. What a difference. So the reason these things are significant is because they are the basis for Jesus' forgiveness of sins in the new covenant. In fact, the whole rest of the Old Testament is just the story of this guy and his kids. You could say the whole rest of the Bible, including the New Testament, is the story of this guy and his kids. Which means, now we're in chapter 12 of Genesis. The first 11 chapters of Genesis are nothing but introduction to get you ready to meet this guy. So that's your perspective. Now remember, we're doing the 80-20. Now you think, well, that doesn't look like such a big deal, but I'm telling you, this is a big deal. You understand this, that these covenants are like a skeleton for the rest of the Bible. It gives you a framework to work with. These are promises. Let's look at him actually making the covenant. Turn over to Genesis chapter 15. Here we see the covenant cut, and I'm going to ask Denton to read the first three verses of 15.
After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me, for I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. And Abram said, Behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, This man shall not be your heir, for your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, Look toward heaven and number the stars. If you are able to number them, then he said to him, So shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness.
Who knows how old Abraham is or was about the time God started making all these promises to him? Well, he was 75 or so. So he's already pretty old. What made this promise of him having kids so unique? A lot of people have kids. Presumably, if she was about his age, anyhow, they'd been married a long time and she'd never had any kids. And now he's 75 and God said they're going to have kids. So that's kind of unique all by itself. What question does Abraham ask God?
This other guy going to tell you, or he's going to take over this promise that you're giving.
So he's thinking, you know, I'm getting pretty old. I still haven't had any kids. You must want me to adopt somebody. That's what he's really thinking, isn't it? So he wanted to know, basically, God, how is your promise going to be fulfilled here? I'm not getting this. I mean, I think that's a reasonable question. God starts off, though, in verse 1 by telling him not to be afraid. Now, based on what Abraham asked him, what might Abraham have been afraid of? I'll give you a hint. He wasn't afraid of the Canaanites. What was he afraid of? He didn't have any kids. I was afraid maybe I misunderstood. Must be I'm supposed to adopt. And so Abraham thinks it's going to be Eliezer. In verses 4 and 5, when Denton read that, how does God answer the question about it being Eliezer?
He says, no, it's not
going to happen. It's going to be instead somebody actually from your own loins, so to speak. That's right. In fact, as many as there are stars in the heavens. That's a lot of stars. What's very significant, let's reread verse 6 real loud, Ed. According to verse 6, why did God credit Abraham righteousness?
He believed in the Lord and he counted him righteousness.
Abraham was counted as righteous. Why? Because he believed. So the inspired writings indicate that salvation comes by faith from the very beginning. The earliest chapters of Genesis tell you salvation is by faith. So in Romans chapter 4, Paul is dealing with people who taught a false gospel, and he calls Abraham to the witness stand. And he says, Romans chapter 4, verse 1, what then shall we say was gained by Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh? If Abraham was justified by works, doing good stuff, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does Scripture say? And then he quotes our passage, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Now, to the one who works, his wages not credited as a gift, but as what is due. Now, somebody explain that to me. What does that mean?
If I work all day for something and then you say, I'm going to give you a gift, here's your pay, that's not much of a gift.
It's not a gift at all, is it? That's right. Do you understand that?
Right.
So if you work your way to heaven, when God gives you salvation, you earned it. It's not a gift. He says, but to the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteousness. And then he calls David to the witness stand. King David, just as David also speaks of the blessing of the one to whom God counts righteousness. How? Apart from works. Now, in South Africa, what did they call it when they kept the blacks and the whites apart?
Apartheid.
Apartheid, you see. So there's apartheid between what?
Righteousness
and works. And the Greek word is chasma. The word chasm. There's a chasm. You just can't get there from here. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man against whom the Lord will not count his sin. So the New Testament picks up on this. I want you to notice he calls it a blessing. You're blessed. You're blessed. And what is it God promised would happen through Abraham? That all nations would be blessed. He doesn't bring it out here. He does it later. But this blessing of salvation, actually, we're going to find out later, is directly related to one of the promises God made to Abraham. It's the blessing of justification by faith. What did Abraham believe that got him justified before God? What did he believe? He looked down the tunnel of time and saw Jesus. No, he didn't. What did he believe? That God would give him kids. He's not likely to have kids. His wife never has had kids. He's about too old to have them. In fact, he was 99, I think, before he finally did. Isn't that right? And yet, he believed God would give life to his dead body and Sarah's dead womb so they would have kids. That's something from the dead, isn't it? What is it you have to believe to have righteousness? Same thing in what sense?
That God would give life to our dead body.
Somebody else's dead body. Who? The dead body of Jesus and rose him from the dead. You're close to right, of course, Adam. And this is how it says in Romans. In hope, he, Abraham, believed against hope that he should become the father of many nations, as he had been told. So shall your offspring be. Again, quoting from Genesis. He did not weaken in faith when he considered his own body, which was as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, or when he considered the barrenness of Sarah's womb. No distrust made him waver concerning the promise of God. But he grew strong in his faith as he gave glory to God, fully convinced that God was able to do what he had promised. Now, throughout the Bible, there's a contrast between works and promise. Works and promise. Your salvation is a result of promise, not works. This is why his faith was, quote, counted to him as righteousness. Going back to Genesis again. But the words, it was counted to him, watch this, were not written for his sake alone. Why? But for ours also. It will be counted to us who believe in him who raised from the dead, Jesus our Lord, who is delivered up for our trespasses and raised for our justification. So whereas he believed he'd have kids and God gave him righteousness, what you're called on to believe is that God rose Jesus from the dead. He was delivered up on the cross to pay for our trespasses and raised from the dead for our justification. You've got to believe that. I guess in that sense, there's no such thing as easy believism. It's not easy to believe that. It's the supernatural work of God when somebody really does. One thing I want you to walk away is, from the very beginning, salvation has always been by faith as a result of promise. It's a gift. It's not something you can work for. And there's this contrast between promise and work. Second thing I want you to see is that this blessing given to Abraham ultimately was the blessing of justification by faith. And that same blessing is given to all peoples around the world who have the same faith of Abraham. Y'all understand that? Notice, why was this written? For our sake also. When you read the Old Testament, you don't let the Old Testament interpret the New. All that stuff in the Old Testament was written, why? For your sake. On the other side of the cross. So we start with the new and we read back into the old. It gives it its fuller significance. That stuff in the Old Testament is for our sake. But we let the new interpret the old, not the other way around. For instance, it says, Moses said, look, if you got a cow, oxen in these tracks, doing this thing, doing the grain, you know, around the pole, what should you not do to the ox? Don't murder him. See, some stingy people didn't want the ox eating some of the grain that he was grinding. And they said, that's cruel and unusual. Let him eat while he works. Paul writes about it. He says, God doesn't care about oxen. What should you learn from that, according to Paul?
Preachers
need to get their living from the church. See, that's letting the new interpret the old, give significance to the old. So going back to this, I want you to see, as we are trying to get the big picture of the Bible and how it all fits together, one idea is you let the new interpret the old, not the other way around. Let's go back to Genesis 15. Well, let's read 7 through 11. Abraham's full of questions. He's going to want some more stuff from God. So now read 7 through 11.
And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. But he said, O Lord God, how am I to know that I shall possess it? He said to him, bring me a heifer 3 years old, a female goat 3 years old, a ram 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he brought him all these, cut them in half, and laid each half over against the other. But he did not cut the birds in half. And when birds of prey came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away.
This all started from a question. What does Abraham want to know this time? I'd like some reassurance that I'm really going to get this land. That's what he's asking for, isn't it? Now, God starts off by bringing something to Abraham's attention in verse 7. What does God start off pointing out in verse 7? I already done this. I got you from Ur here. And so now God, the one that changed the subject from kids to real estate. And so since God changed the subject, Abraham runs with it. Well, how do I know, God? He's been living there all these years. He wants some reassurance. And so God tells him to do something in 9 through 11. What does he tell him to do? Bunch of animals. Cut them in half. And that's what all he says. Why did God want him to do that? What's about to happen? About to sign a contract. That's right. Today we say you're going to cut a deal. Back then you say you cut a covenant. What's gotten cut? These animals. Why did they cut these animals in half? What would happen? Who knows?
They would die.
Yes, the animals would die. And then, you had to be pretty rich to do this. Usually it was kings and countries. So the parties, usually two kings, would walk in a kind of a figure eight between these animal halves. And what did that symbolize, Dan?
If we break this covenant, let this happen to us.
That's what that meant. This is a life-death covenant, so it's for serious. Now, we don't do that today, but that is what they did. Archaeologists have found references to this. You even see it in Jeremiah's time. It was still being done. And it's just a reference to this same type of covenant. And the men who transgressed my covenant and did not keep the terms of the covenant that they made before me, I will make them like the calf that they cut in two and pass between his parts. The officials of Judah, the officials of Jerusalem, the eunuchs, the priests, all the people of the land who passed between the parts of the calf. It's completely different. But it's the same type of covenant being made. So Abraham understands this is like a covenant kings are going to make. God is going to bind himself. This is a do or die contract. Y'all see that? Talk about verse 11. I would like to know why verse 11 is significant. I would like a lady or a college student to tell me. Adam is exactly right. Things didn't happen right away. When God started talking to Abraham in this chapter, was it night or day? He took him outside. Yeah. And he showed him the stars. It's nighttime. He sees the stars. So sun comes up. And they're still talking. And so he goes. He gets these animals. He cuts the pieces in half. And he waits. And he waits. And he waits. And what starts appearing in the sky? Buzzards. Now, they don't fly at night, do they? So, and then they get so bold to come down, he's got to go shoo them away. And he sits there so long. Where are we? Verse 11? Is that where that is? Yeah, he said, so time has passed. In fact, in verse 12, the sun is going down. So he's been sitting all day in the hot sun, shooing off buzzards, waiting for God to show up. Because he expects somehow God's going to show up, and they're going to do this covenant thing. So let's look at what happens in 12 through 16. As the sun is setting, look what happens to Abraham and these animals. 12 through 16.
As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram. And behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterwards they shall come out with great possessions. As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete."
What happens to Abraham? He is asleep. And what's he feeling while he's sleeping? Gloom and doom. And then God speaks to him. And what gloomy prophecy does God make? Good news is you're going to have a lot of kids. Bad news is they're all going to be slaves. Now, I think the gloom and doom are probably stage effects. God's moving on him, you know. And this land that's not theirs is what land? Egypt. Egypt is where they were enslaved for how long? But there is good news in verse 14 and 16. What's good news? They come out of Egypt with great possessions and presumably back into the promised land, which is called what? Guatemala. Now, in 17 through 21, look what happens next. Now, Nathan, read that. 17 through 21.
When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "To your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Cadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites.
Not to forget the Electrolytes.
I was 12 before I knew an Israelite was in a lamp. What happened to the animal pieces while he's asleep? This flaming torch oven thing goes in between the pieces. What's Abraham doing all this time?
Nothing.
He's sleeping. Now, the Hebrew literally says God, on that day, cut a covenant with Abraham while he's asleep. God, for reasons unknown to me, shows up as a blast furnace and goes around between these pieces. If Abraham was asleep, how does he know that's what happened? Maybe things got burned as they went. Maybe if you drag a big oven, you've got a wood stove out in the yard and try to drag it around. Probably a lot of things. Maybe his servants were there. You know, the guy's filthy rich. You know, he probably had his servants. Maybe they're all watching. Maybe they saw the whole thing. Or maybe he's seen it like on television. He's already God speaking to him in a vision, right? So maybe he's seeing this happening while it's happening, like he's watching it on TV. I don't know. But God shows up like a smoking furnace, and Abraham knows exactly what's happened once it's done. What's the significance of this smoking oven passing between the pieces without Abraham? Nick?
It's on God. It wasn't two people making a covenant. It was God.
Okay. So this is not 50-50. What is it? 100-0. He said, Abraham, it doesn't matter what you do, this is going to happen. Abraham, you can't screw this up. And you know what the rest of Genesis is? The story of Abraham screwed it up, and God won't let him. And Isaac tries to screw it up, and Jacob tries to screw it up, and God won't let them. Isn't it a good thing our salvation's that way? You won't get it if it's dependent on you. So this is an unconditional covenant. Now the Bible in the New Testament talks about that. It says the promises, there we go again, promises were made to Abraham and his offspring. The law, now that's the old covenant, which came 430 years afterwards, does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God, the one with Abraham, so as to make the promise void. For if the inheritance comes by the law, it no longer comes by promise, but God gave it to Abraham by a promise. So it's just picking up on the fact of what we already know. What did God promise Abraham in this covenant? Verse 18, what's he promising? So he gives him real estate. That's what he promises him. And tell me again what modern day nation or nations occupy this land?
Guatemala.
It's basically modern day Israel, as you know. If you take it literally, which might be a stretch, it would include the eastern part of Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula, all of Israel and Jordan, and the western part of Syria. It could just be atomic directions. I don't know how precise he wants to be. The river of Egypt probably is not the Nile River. It's probably a different river, the Wadi el-Arish in northwest Sinai. But anyway, I don't know. It even refers to the Euphrates River, which is getting a good ways away. So that's a big area. Tell me again the big three promises that we even see touched on right here in Genesis 12 and 15. The seed promise and the land promise. Now, right here, he doesn't mention the blessing. These two. 25 years go by, you know what happens? Nothing. So, God shows up again in chapter 17, and he decides to reconfirm this covenant with Abraham. And look what he promises. Let's read verses 7 and 8 of that and see what God promises. Ed, read that for me.
And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your offspring after you. And I will give to you and your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God.
We got something new this time. What new thing does he throw in there? Dan anticipated it, but this is where he actually says it. What's new here? I will be their God. So God has this unique God-people relationship with Israel that he had with no other country of the world before or since. So he's going to establish this covenant, and he makes it not only with Abraham, but it says in verse 7, between Abraham and all his offspring or seed. And according to verse 7, how long is it supposed to be in effect? Everlasting. So of the big three promises, Which of those three are dealt with here in what Ed read? Does he say the word blessing? I didn't see that. I saw the seed in the land. Is the blessing there?
Well, it's a blessing to be your God.
Well, no, that is a blessing. I'll give you that one. Okay, we'll take that. And tell me again how long they're supposed to be in that land? Forever. That's a long time. Now look at chapter 17, 9 through 14. Every covenant back then had a sign. Now we don't do that much today except for the marriage covenant, which is the sign of the wedding ring. But what is the sign of the covenant?
Well, the sign of the covenant was circumcision.
That's right.
God said to Abraham, "Now, as for you, you shall keep my covenant and you your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant, which I will keep between me and you and the descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. And you shall be circumcised in the flesh in your foreskin. And it shall be a sign of your covenant between me and you."
Why do you think God picked circumcision? Of all the stuff he could have come up with, that was a pretty painful sign. Why does he pick that? What's it got to do with children?
Procreation.
Well, it's a male thing. It does have something to do with children, Nick.
When a female, you would know at that point in time your belief.
That's right.
Oh, well, you might believe this.
Yeah, right. So what we're talking about here is ethnic purity. You're supposed to marry in the tribe. And they weren't supposed to marry the Canaanites. He doesn't give any of these as reasons, but they make sense, don't they? Do the Jews still do that today? Yeah, you better believe it. So there you have it. Now, the New Testament deals with this. I want to look at the relationship between circumcision and salvation and baptism and salvation. He says, "We say that faith was counted to Abraham as righteousness." By the way, I'm reading from Romans 4. "How then was it counted to him? Was it before or after he had been circumcised?" What's the answer?
Before.
It was not after, but before he was circumcised. He received the sign of circumcision as a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. Now, recently we had some guys wanted to come to church here who are Church of Christ. They teach as part of the gospel, you've got to be baptized in order to be saved. It's not enough to have faith. You've got to be baptized. To me, that's a false gospel. That's no different than the Judaizers who taught it's not enough to believe in Jesus. You got to be circumcised. So Paul's dealing with that error here. And he's pointing out that it was years prior to being circumcised that Abraham was declared righteous by faith. So it's the same with us. Now, go back to verse 13 of Genesis. How long did God intend for this covenant to be in effect? It says everlasting. If you're Jewish and you're a Christian, you should ask yourself, is it a sin because of this verse for me as a Jewish Christian not to circumcise my sons? Because if this is still in effect today, we should put people like Keith out of the church if they don't have their sons circumcised. Because it says here, it's supposed to be everlasting. That brings us up to the importance of discussing the word everlasting. The Hebrew word is olam, as you see there. If you look it up in a Hebrew dictionary, it means most distant times, whether in the past or in the future, as I'll show you in just a minute. In some contexts, it can mean everlasting, because that's pretty distant, isn't it? But all your dictionaries are going to tell you this. Neither the Hebrew or the Greek in itself contains the idea of what? Endlessness. Now, in English, we have a word for forever. He's saying they didn't. You know what it meant? It meant a long time. They understood forever. And sometimes it means forever, but mostly it doesn't mean forever. Most of the time it means a long time. Here's an example from 1 Samuel. "As soon as the child is weaned," Hannah says, "I will bring Samuel, so may he and may appear in the presence of the Lord." Remember, she took him to, was it Eli? Took him to Eli, and he lived there in the temple. "So that he may dwell there how long?"
Forever.
Says forever. Is he still there now? He died of old age. Then this thing's gone. See, "I have lent him to the Lord." As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord. See, now they were consistent. They put forever. But the word doesn't mean that necessarily. It mostly means a long time.
A few minutes ago, we were talking about the covenant. You said, "How long is this covenant for?" And you said, "Forever." And we use that as a definite mark, saying the covenant's forever.
Maybe it's not. Andy's got a good point. I purposely didn't deal with that there, and I'm going to bring it up here. Just because your English says forever, the translators have to decide whether it's forever or not. The mercy of the Lord endures forever. They'll say that. Well, they know God's attributes don't change. So, okay, they feel pretty safe putting that. But they have to make decisions. So we want, as we go on next time we discuss this, we're going to see, is there anything else in the Bible that would help us understand whether we should take our passage to be forever or whether we should take it to be a really long time? Because the Jews were in the land 2,000 years. Is that a long time? Well, that's a pretty long time. But we would want to see later if there's something in the New Testament that suggests it's okay for Jewish guys not to circumcise their children, or if that land is still for the Jews. Might be. Might not. I just want you to see the word here does not fundamentally mean forever, even though it might be translated that way. Here's another example of where it's not. Achish believed David, saying, "He has surely made himself odious among his people. Therefore, he will become my servant forever." And that's why to this day, everybody knows King David is still a slave to Achish. Because it's forever, right? Now, they both died of old age. He's just meant for a long time. You see that? Most of the time, that's all the word means. Olam does not necessarily contain the idea of endlessness, but rather of a long duration of time. So I'm just raising the flag there. Maybe this covenant is still in effect. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's not. The big three things are land, seed, and blessing. It's mentioned here. Look, here's Genesis 18. Nations of the earth are going to be blessed in Abraham. Here's Genesis 22. I'm going to give you offspring, all the nations of the earth. Genesis 26. I'm going to multiply your offspring. I'm going to give you land. All the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. Here's Genesis 26. I'm going to bless you. You're going to have offspring. Here's Genesis 28. You're going to have land. You're going to have seed. And all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. This is over and over and over and over in the Bible. That's why I said people who studied the whole thing boil it down to those three promises. Genesis 35. Whole nation is going to come out of you. I'm going to give you land. Genesis 46, he says, you're going to be a great nation. Now, we're going down the generations now, his various descendants, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, to Joseph, you see up there. Genesis 48, you're going to be fruitful, multiply, you're going to have land for a long time. Everlasting, it says here. Genesis 50, Joseph picked up on that promise. God's given us land. Exodus chapter 2, they gave him the land of Canaan. Exodus 32, I'm going to give you offspring to live on the land. Joshua 14, surely the land is yours forever. 1 Chronicles 16, I'm going to give you land as your inheritance. The Psalms refer to it. I'll give you the land. Anyway, the question we haven't dealt with, but I've just raised the question of, is the Abrahamic covenant still in effect today? Well, we're going to wonder that. But I'm telling you, whether it's in effect today or not, it is the basis for the new covenant, Jesus, forgiveness of sins, and you go into heaven. If it wasn't for these promises to Abraham, none of that would happen. That's the central theme throughout the whole Bible. And the application you can walk away with today is, based on Abraham's example, how can a person be declared righteous by God? Faith! Not joining the church, not taking the Lord's Supper, not being baptized, not living a good life. Faith! Now, you will do all those things if you have faith, but what justifies you is faith. And what can we learn about water baptism from Abraham's circumcision? It's not salvific. But if you have salvation, you should get baptized. Amen. The next time, when we're doing the overview, we're going to integrate this with the new covenant. At some point, we're going to look at the old covenant, what I was about, and I'm going to integrate that with the new covenant. And finally, we're going to look at the new covenant.
This message was produced by the New Testament Reformation Fellowship, reforming today's church with New Testament church practice. Permission is hereby granted for you to reproduce this message. To learn more about New Testament church life, you can find us on the web at ntrf.org. God bless you as you seek to follow Him in obedience. May your faith in the Lord Jesus be strengthened and your daily walk with Him deepened.